I'm so happy to be with you today. I'm here on the coast of Maine, and I've been in Oregon a little bit. I had an uncle who lived there for many, many years, and I do feel some connection to that area. A few days before the infamous attack on our nation's Capitol building in 2021, Nicholas Fuentes, a 23-year-old far-right white nationalist commentator and live streamer, spoke at a rally in Washington, D.C., saying these words, quote, "It is us and our ancestors that created everything good that you see in this country. All these people that have taken over our country, we do not need them. It is the American people and our leader, Donald Trump, against everybody else in this country and this world," close quote. This is one of the most concise representations I've heard of the philosophy underlying the ideological pandemic, which we have been struggling against, not just since 2016, although the effort has certainly been intense in that time, but since the impulse of liberal religion first declared that how we live with one another is more important than loyalty to any creed. We do not need them. Words that sever the most elemental truth of our existence, that we are interdependent, that we are connected. Words that add fuel to a national discourse centered on what should we fear and who should we blame? Words that impede the possibility of belonging, of being somewhere where you want to be and they want you. We do not need them. Words that reinforce the myth of scarcity, which drives contemporary capitalism, which reveres ownership as the ultimate good, which regards every element of our universe, including people's bodies, as a commodity which can be owned. The rock upon which white supremacy was built. The motivation for dehumanization. Dehumanization that is fundamental to a system of power over, of divide and conquer, of us versus them. It's not new to humanity, but just as physical viruses can mutate into novel forms, which can be deadlier than their progenitors, zero-sum worldviews keep festering and reinfecting our world. How will we respond? If the virus of dehumanization cannot be eradicated, are there ways to inoculate against it? Can we work to boost immunity, to rehumanize? How would we go about it? We can commit to reconnecting, and we can begin with gritty hospitality. Some of us, including myself, grew up in a culture where hospitality was about being nice. Gestures, behaviors like saying, "yes, ma'am," and "no, sir," which I still often default to unconsciously. It felt comforting to some, and it represented a formula, not unlike a creed, in which rote compliance offered the salvation of social acceptance, a flimsy facade covering a reality of oppression in a culture in which there was a strict hierarchy of human value based on race, assigned gender, religion, age, wealth, education, physical ability. The word hospitality is complex when we consider its origins. The Latin words hostis and hospice, because those words encompass the concepts of stranger, enemy, visitor, guest, and host. Including such diverse roles within the same word presents hospitality not as politeness, but as a process of relationship. Gritty indicates it is courageously persistent and embodies tough, uncompromising realism. A gritty hospitality that abets rehumanization is tough, courageous, persistent, and realistic. It gives priority to relationship rather than comfort, opens to all, and generates effervescence, which pours forth to continue the process. Our service today began with the words, open up the doors, brace shoulders against the weight of history unmoved, slough off the musty smell of unused joy and stored up sorrow, knock rust off the hinges if you have to. I don't know what closed the doors the author of those words was thinking of, and I can't speak for anyone else, including a congregation, but I know what it's like to be afraid and to want to protect myself. I know how easily one can become accustomed to being in a refuge, maybe even forgetting that the closed door that is keeping fear out can also keep our sorrows stored up and our joys unsung. The reality of opening ourselves to the world requires vulnerability. Gritty hospitality means asking, what do you need of every person we encounter in our ministry? And then listening, not rushing to assess what is available or to fix someone else's problem, listening to hear their reality. Gritty hospitality listens first and then says, tell me more. It encourages the equation of belonging. It says, we want you to be here. It can be as simple and momentous as the first time I walked into a Unitarian Universalist congregation 20 years ago. The person who greeted me right inside the door, after introducing themselves and saying they were happy I came, asked me to complete a name tag. Then they asked me whether I wanted to be announced as a visitor during the service. That sounds like such a simple thing. They had no way of knowing that I was dealing with a relapse of my clinical depression, that it took every drop of courage I had to walk in the door that morning, that what I needed was to sit quietly in the back row where I could escape if necessary. They didn't assume that I was like anyone else. They asked, how do you want to enter our community? What do you need to connect? And they listened. Their willingness to connect with me at the level I needed brought me back the next week. And here I am, a UU minister now. Gritty hospitality is opening the doors as far as they will go, opening all that we are. It may mean venturing out in new ways despite our real and valid fears, being willing to carry our message outside our walls with courageous persistence and not just in demonstrations. Perhaps sponsoring an anti-racism book club in a public library rather than at the church, because there might be new opportunities for connecting there. It might be offering our whole lives for older adults in a retirement community because healthy sexual expression can rehumanize people. Or putting some of our social justice energy into playing a support role for the work of a nearby Black church, despite differences in our theologies. It could be putting up a Black Lives Matter banner that will almost certainly be vandalized and using every occasion of vandalism as another opportunity to publicly share our message of universal love. It is experimenting with ideas that are creative enough to spark change, accepting risk, trying uncomfortable new approaches, and abandoning perfectionism, recognizing that there is no failure. There is only learning. Some people might think some of that sounds a little bit like evangelism. And it's possible that someone in our group today might have shuddered just a bit as I said that word out loud. That's how I used to feel in the decades that I was in evangelical churches, and with good reason, because I sucked at witnessing until I found Unitarian Universalism. That change of heart puzzled me. I began to find my answer by digging into what the word evangelize originally meant. When we look up the word today, we often see the words convert or conversion front and center in the definition, Those words scare us, and they should, when they represent an intention of othering, of casting out in order to define who will be gathered in. But it's not what the word originally meant. Evangelize means sharing good news, sharing joy. We do it every week. When we share our joys in our services, we are evangelizing. I'm just talking about a difference in scale. That is how I feel when I witness about Unitarian Universalism. I'm not trying to convert, because I'm not trying to draw any lines to cast anyone out. I am allowing my joy to pour forth into the world. And I refuse to let other people's perversion of the concept prevent me from practicing it. And when I do find myself hesitant to let that joy pour out, I most often find that I am worried that the other person in the conversation might not fit in at my congregation, might not like it, might not like me. That's when I remind myself that Unitarian Universalism at its best is not about fitting in, but about belonging. As part of the interdependent web of existence, which I comprehend as creative interaction based in love, pouring out my joy is about loving people, not about their approval. If we have universal love as an intention, we must grapple with inclusion. I learned something about hospitality and inclusion when I volunteered to be in charge of my maternal grandmother's 80th birthday party many years ago. We don't do birthday parties for grown-ups in my family, but two of my grandparents had already passed away, and I saw it as a way of honoring my grandmother and creating good memories for us grandkids. At that point in my life, I was considering a career in food hospitality, like catering, so I also saw it as a chance to get some experience. I planned a menu, and I asked different people in the family to make certain dishes in precise quantities. I didn't ask my mom to make something because I wanted to give her a break. I told her she didn't need to bring anything. She showed up with three dishes she had prepared. What was I going to do? She's my mom. I put them on the table. We had our party and it was great. At the end, the amount of food left over was slightly more than the amount my mom had brought. Turns out I was right about the amount of food we needed based on who I invited. But I later came to realize the important lesson was about my mother's philosophy of hospitality, which mandates being prepared for everybody who could show up. Greedy hospitality is inclusive. Welcome is at the top of the priority list. Are we ready for the people who are not yet here? If we're not, we know we can renovate ourselves. How many of our congregations have already become welcoming congregations, or green sanctuaries, or sanctuary congregations? Those hospitality processes all began with an intention to open the door wider, and they always involved knocking some rust off the hinges. Are our doors and our floors and our hearts and our hopes and our minds open and ready for those who could show up, even though we may not have invited them yet? Greedy hospitality may be inspired by love, but it is hard work. Where do we find the energy? Collective effervescence is a term introduced by Emile Durkheim more than a century ago to describe the sense of connection, communal emotion, and sensation of being part of something bigger than ourselves that he observed in religious ritual. Many people also experience it at concerts, sporting events, and protest marches. In recent years, positive psychology researchers have found that the sense of meaning and connection, which grows collective effervescence, can happen in much smaller gatherings and less dramatic activities than we previously thought. We fill one another with effervescent energy whenever we gather together. This might be part of the explanation of how many congregations exceeded their own expectations when it came to moving to online worship. Some of us did not expect so many people to work so hard, to learn so much, just in order to show up. Small group ministry and religious education for all ages are also forms of connecting to that that generate collective effervescence. The more we care for one another in settings which nurture vulnerability and courageous caring, the more we can recharge for the work of rehumanizing the world. Why do we need to do this? Make a wholehearted commitment to reconnecting, to the work of rehumanizing, to gritty hospitality. We might first commit to reconnecting because we feel the pain and suffering of loneliness around us that comes from dehumanization. When we engage with that commitment, the first people we will change will be ourselves. When we open our heart's door, when we embrace vulnerability, when we dive into change and swim in the current, we change. We change our hearts. Then we rewire our neural pathways and change our minds. When we open the doors wider and more light flows through in every direction, we change our eyes. Not our physical eyes, but our spiritual vision. When we commit to reconnecting, we weave tighter the strands of interdependence. We embody the truth that we need everyone. When we keep loving, we also change and save ourselves. May it be so.